This is huge for tribes in Alaska, and it really opens the door for a new relationship with the state.
Another legal hurdle is cleared for tribes wanting lands put into trust. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists work to understand the cause of recent whale deaths.
It would tend to suggest that the animal may have been debilitated or there was some degree of immunosuppression.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Tribes in Alaska can move forward with petitioning the federal government to take lands into trust. A federal appeals court today dismissed the state of Alaska's challenge in the trust litigation. Indian country status in Alaska would afford similar protections as reservation lands in the lower 48. In 2007, Alaska tribes sued the Interior Department for the right to take land into trust after a legal opinion from the Interior Department said it was discriminatory to treat tribes in Alaska differently from tribes in the lower 48, the state continued its challenge in the case. Attorney Heather Kendall Miller brought the case for the tribes. She says today's decision is a big deal.
Tribes in Alaska will be able to pursue the ability to have BIA consider these petitions to have lands moved into trust. So that's huge for Alaska tribes because, as the court points out in its opinion, the Department of Interior, giving this a hard look during the rulemaking, recognized that trust lands are absolutely essential to tribes for many, many different reasons, for public safety, for economic development, to preserve land and cultural resources. And so this is huge for tribes in Alaska, and it really opens the door for a new relationship with the state, should the state decide to stop fighting tribes on this issue and work with tribes. It could create all kinds of potential partnerships. And it remains to be seen, of course, what the governor and the attorney general's office will do. But our hope is, as we've seen recently, the governor has chosen not to seek a petition in the Clinton and Haida case. And our hope is that he will continue to have that reasoned and approach to the benefits that can be gained from working with tribes and not against them.
It does beg the question, Congressman Don Young has said in the past, why would tribes want to put land into trust? Why would they want the federal government to essentially own those lands and hold them for the tribes? It would mean that then they are adding tremendous layers of bureaucracy. Why would they want to do that? Why would they want to?
Well, in the case of our clients, they were very clear that three of the four wanted to be able to enhance their regulatory jurisdiction to keep alcohol out and to be able to invoke the Indian liquor laws that would require the federal prosecutor's office to prosecute bootleggers and others that have been bringing alcohol into the community and drugs in the community. As I think you and I know, the state is frequently absent with respect to providing adequate police authority in Village Alaska. This would be an incredible tool for villages in rural Alaska to be able to enforce ordinances declaring that their villages are dry. Another reason that one of our plaintiff tribes wanted to be able to have the option of placing lands into trust is because they have property that is being heavily taxed by a very aggressive borough. And the tribe wants to be able to protect that 10-acre land base from borough taxation and be able to develop it economically to provide income for the tribe.
What's next now? This decision was put out today, what happens?
What happens is that the stay gets lifted and the Department of Interior will, you know, publish notice of the existing petitions that have come in and will start the processing of those. And I would assume that the tribes that have submitted those petitions will be in contact with the Interior and trying to urge it to move their process along as quickly as possible.
State Law Department spokesperson Corey Mills says the state will review the current decision and decide how to proceed. Kendall Miller says now that the stay against Alaska tribal petitions has been lifted, the BIA will publish notice of those trust land applications within 30 days. The ivory market in America just got a lot smaller, or at least that's how it seems. A new law goes into effect today in California that bans the sale of all ivory products, including walrus ivory. Alaska natives are protected under a federal law, but as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, confusion and inconsistency between state and federal legislation has caused concern.
John Cookalook Sr. is sitting at his carving booth at the King Island Native Community Building. He's an ivory carver and has the hands to prove it.
I try to make a little bit of everything. Masks, polar bears, wolves. Carve quite a few walrus teeth.
He's working on one of those teeth today. Dust flies through the air as he drills tiny holes into the 2-inch piece of ivory that he'll later fill in with baleen. Cookalook was born and raised in Nome, but his family is from King Island. When members of the Inupiaq community were forced to relocate to the mainland in the 1960s, they brought the long-standing tradition of ivory carving with them.
It's in our culture. It was passed down, you know, long before my time. And I feel fortunate to have this talent.
I love it. I love ivory carving. You know, we get to say whatever we want with our work.
Just like Cookalook, Susie Silik has been carving for decades. She's originally from the St. Lawrence Island community of Gamble. It's that love of carving that led Silik to start an online petition opposing California's new law that bans the sale of all ivory. Section 2 of Assembly Bill 96 defines ivory as, quote, a tooth or tusk from a species of elephant, hippopotamus, mammoth, walrus, whale, or narwhal.
And so this is kind of creating this confusion out there that all the materials listed in these laws is illegal now.
But they're not. The Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 makes the interstate sale of walrus ivory legal through its definition of authentic native handicrafts. Gay Sheffield is a biologist with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program in Nome.
Authentic native handicrafts are defined as items that are produced, decorated, or fashioned in the exercise of traditional native handicrafts.
Sheffield says the handicraft definition includes, but is not limited to,
weaving, carving, stitching, sewing, lacing, beading, drawing, and painting.
Sheffield says she understands the effort to protect elephant and other tusked animals in Africa from poachers, but they're not one and the same with the marine mammal she studies in the Bering Strait region.
The general public thinks ivory, elephant, dead elephant rotting in the sun, beautiful elephant with little baby, because it's always on the TV, on the documentaries. What they don't see is walrus ivory, legal harvest, food on the table, economic benefit to rural Alaskans.
It's that economic benefit that has many worried. Carver Susie Silik says ivory brings much-needed cash into rural communities like Gamble. She remembers a buyer from southeast Alaska traveling to the St. Lawrence Island community in the mid-1990s.
Within 3 days, he had purchased $20,000 worth of arts and crafts from the people in just one village. And this is just one buyer.
But now buyers are reacting to California's new legislation. Robert James manages Miraskaya's, a well-known native art shop on Nome's Front Street. He buys from carvers like John Cookalook Sr. and sells their crafts in town and on the road. James had planned to stop at this year's American Indian Art Show outside of San Francisco.
Because of the legislation that passed, I don't think we'll ever be back there. So, yeah, we might have to find a different show.
Back at the King Island Carving Room, John Cookalook Sr. continues to drill tiny holes into the walrus tooth he holds in one hand. He worries about the confusion the new California law will create for buyers, But Kukluk says that won't stop him from carrying on the tradition his ancestors have been practicing for centuries.
I feel that I'll be doing this regardless of what happens, probably till the day I'm gone.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the challenge of living on a remote radar site.
I told the guys if they wanted milk, they had to go out to the barn and milk the cow. And if they wanted any eggs, they had to go down to the beach and get the seagull eggs down there. That was the closest thing to eggs they were getting from me.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Researchers are trying to determine what caused the deaths of three large whales along Alaska's coastline within a single week in late June, and whether the fatal strandings might be related to a big spike in whale deaths in the region last year. A fin whale died in Kinnick Arm near Anchorage on June 22nd. 4 days later, a humpback was found dead off Point Carlos in Glacier Bay National Park, and 2 days after that, another humpback was found in Turnagain Arm near Hope. Investigators with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and partner groups have taken tissue samples from all three whales. The Glacier Bay humpback, which had been observed by scientists since the late 1960s and was nicknamed Festus, may provide the most clues because researchers were able to conduct a full necropsy. British Columbia veterinary pathologist Steve Raverty led the postmortem and said there was no evidence of skull or other bone fractures, but there were indications the whale wasn't healthy.
They have these copepod parasites. They're known as sort of whale lice. And this animal had probably the most abundant numbers that we've seen in animals that have stranded throughout the area. And it would tend to suggest that the animal may have been debilitated or there was some degree of immunosuppression. In addition, when we cut into the blubber, we found that there was very little oil. And it would suggest that the animal probably wasn't consuming enough nutrition or enough energy to sustain its normal body condition.
No, officials don't know if these recent deaths are related to the dozens of whale deaths in the Gulf of Alaska last year. Those 2015 strandings were labeled an unusual mortality event, and the cause is still under investigation. It could be a difficult mystery to solve because so many of the carcasses were too decomposed or too remote to study. Raverty says the recent whale deaths could help researchers better understand last year's die-off.
We look at these individuals that are now stranding in 2016 as a really unique opportunity to try and establish baseline health and understanding whether there may be evidence of ship strike, infectious disease, exposure to the harmful algal blooms. And these will all be put in the context of what had occurred historically, but also during the unusual mortality event.
Samples from the whales have been sent to labs for analysis, but it's not clear when researchers will know more about how and why they died. Among the governor's lists of vetoes is $6.5 million in cuts to the Department of Health and Social Services. One is slated for substance abuse treatment pilot programs, another for children's services. But even with those cuts, the department will still be getting extra money for those services next year. When setting the budget, the legislature included additional funds over last year. $11 million was added to create new substance abuse treatment programs like detox centers and residential treatment. When the governor cut that amount down to $6 million, Division of Behavioral Health Director Randall Burns says he was still happy.
Yes. I think any additional funding that the legislature and the governor are willing to provide for substance abuse, new substance abuse services in Alaskan communities is very positive news.
Office of Children's Services will see a positive boost as well. The legislature has slated an additional $2.3 million for the department on top of their regular budget for two purposes: preventative programs that help families work through problems and stay together, and reunification programs to help restore families if kids are put into foster care. $1.7 million of that money will stay in the budget. OCS Director Christy Lawton says she's grateful.
So they're really all funds to help supplement and enhance what the OCS caseworker is doing, and oftentimes with the high workload, you know, isn't able to do as much as we'd like to do. So these services really help to kind of accelerate the services we can offer.
The $1 million cut to child care benefits is a reduction from the current budget, but the department does not have a wait list for child care assistance. The decline of Alaska's indigenous languages happened during the era of boarding schools and missionaries. As children, some Alaska Natives were punished for speaking their mother tongue. When those children became adults, many did not speak their language to their children. Acknowledging this generational trauma is what led Cheyenne Chulian Chavaya Beatty to study Han Wuchin, the language of her ancestors. In the fourth of a five-part series, Beatty talks about reclaiming identity through the use of Native names.
Hello, Nijitahonche Shosre Cheyenne Beatty. Hello, how are you doing? My name is Cheyenne Beatty. I am Han Wuchin and Chondek Wuchin Athabaskan from the Han Nation, which resides in Eagle, Alaska, as well as Moose High, Canada, Yukon Territory. My first name that came to me was a Dena'ina Athabaskan name, not a Han Wuchin name. I was at the time working with a Dena'ina Athabaskan in Anchorage, Alaska, and he gave me this name. He said, "You're Chulian Chavaya." And I'm like, "What does that mean?" And he said, "It means raven whirlwind, because you're mischief like a raven and you come in and out of a room like a whirlwind." I think that the reason why people are using their native names or language within their own social identity is the generation of trauma was my grandparents. I've always thought we were Han Gwichin. Well, I started learning more about my language that we're Han Wuchin, which is like H-W-E-C-H-I-N instead of Gwichin. And so I think that more and more people are realizing that just like Aleut people are not just Aleut people. They're Aleutic, they're Sukpiak, they're Unangan, they're Unangach. And we are really taking hold into owning our own identity, being educated by our identity, and making sure that we educate others about that. And that's why I think that we have this surge of people who are really showcasing not only their native language, but their own identity.
That was the fourth in a five-part series on Alaska Native Names produced by KTOO's Jennifer Canfield. A link to the full interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK,
Radar Love.
That's right, Radar Love. Scattered across Alaska are 15 radar sites in some of the most remote areas of the state, feeding information to a command center in Anchorage. Keeping them humming 365 days a year are tiny crews of private contractors who live there for months at a time. To a lot of people, the prospect sounds crazy. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes found out, to others, the solitary rhythm makes total sense.
We have celery and avocados and broccoli, all of the normal normals.
Lita Page gives me a tour of all of her freezers. There are several.
I keep my cheeses here.
How much bacon is that?
About 20-pound lots.
Paige is what's called a service technician at the Cape Romanzoff long-range radar site. It's an Air Force installation at the edge of the Bering Sea, 15 miles from the nearest village. She's basically a combination of a cook, quartermaster, and a housekeeper.
I'll be the mama.
Paige and the three other employees that live here work for ArcTech, a private company that's held the Air Force contract to maintain these radar sites for the last two decades. Back in the 50s and 60s, during the Cold War, these installations were manned by hundreds of service members each. It was considered a hardship posting. Depression and pathological boredom were regular. Tours were kept to just 1 year. Paige has been here for five.
All right, I'm a piddler, and I find something to do all the time.
A piddler, in Paige's telling, is someone who can just find work that needs to get done. She says it's common here that all the technicians are pretty self-directed and don't really need each other for amusement. This isn't her first remote posting. She worked out in Shemya on the tail of the Aleutian chain for 9 years, but left when her husband got sick. After he passed, she signed on with ArcTech. And usually, she works for 2 months straight, then takes a month at home in Anchorage, where she's got a house and can spend uninterrupted time with her grandkids.
I go pick up my grandbaby at daycare, and we go all day long. Now I got two more babies, so I'll have all three of them, and we'll just go, because I don't have to work.
On top of the schedule, it's good money. Generally, technicians make between $120,000 and $150,000 a year, with few expenses while they're on site. There's internet, so people can communicate with their families. ArcTech's workforce is overseen by Kevin Smiley, who says the company screens job applicants to make sure they're the type that can handle remote postings.
We try to work people into it a little bit slower. Your first assignment might not be as such a long stretch, might be a shorter stretch. Kind of sends you out, lets you experience what it's like before you sign up for that 4 month haul somewhere, you know, in the middle of winter.
The vast majority of site techs are former military, many of whom take advantage of the surrounding wilderness.
They find a lot of ways to recreate, you know, whether it's hunting, fishing, gold mining, trapping. They find a lot of things, you know, to keep busy and to do.
Smiley doesn't volunteer the word piddler, but this might meet the definition. He shrugs off the suggestion that these jobs are abnormally extreme. Would you do it?
Would I do it? I would do it. You know, it's like eventually somebody will come and get you, so.
You become very creative.
At Romanzoff, Paige recalls a period where the weather kept out the supply plane for 6 weeks.
Yeah, we didn't have any groceries, anything fresh. So I told the guys if they wanted milk, they had to go out to the barn and milk the cow. And if they wanted any eggs, they had to go down to the beach and get the seagull eggs down there. That was the closest thing to eggs they were getting from me.
Paige keeps showing me around the cavernous insulated dome where the contractors live. Past the industrial kitchen is a dining area, and one floor up is a ring of bedrooms.
Now, if you don't look at the dirt, you can look in my room.
Okay. It looks kind of like a college dorm room that's been permanently settled, with a TV, comfy chair, and an impressive crocheting project tucked neatly in a corner. When Paige shows me the supply depot she's in charge of, my jaw drops, because it's stocked with absolutely every spare provision you could possibly need.
Back in behind here, I got blinds for the windows. And there's some rugs back here. See those black round things? Those are mattresses.
I have the sense that Paige gets a profound satisfaction from being able to comprehensively care for other people. Years before Romanzoff, when she lived in Anchorage, she handled the kitchen at a behavioral health clinic for girls.
There was a lot of sad cases, behavior problems and abuse and everything else. So it was I don't think a kid should be treated that way. And that was probably the hardest part.
At the time, her sons were about the same age as the patients, and her house was the gathering spot for a small tribe of teenage boys.
If I didn't have one boy, I had 10 at my house.
When I ask if keeping a home peppered with lost boys is that far off from mothering a bunch of loners at the remote military site, Paige says, no, not so far off.
When I first started working remote, the station chief told me, he says, Lita, just treat all of the guys like they were kids, and you'll be fine. You won't miss your kids so much then. And actually, I still do.
For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Brian Weed in Juneau. Weed is a correction officer by day and a mine explorer in his free time.
My father used to work on Douglas Island for Department of Transportation, and when I was about 12 years old, he would make me go to work with him in the summertime. Little did he know, the second largest mine in the world, the Treadwell Mine, is located on Douglas Island, about a half mile away from where he worked. I think I had a lighter and maybe a 25 lumen flashlight. And I remember just creeping in very slowly, because I had heard all these stories about pits and mines. You see all these movies where people fall. And so I moved very slow all the way to the back of the mine tunnel, which was just a dumb idea, but when you're 12, you don't know any better. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to share with people the history of Juneau, what's still here, what's off the trails. Juneau is here because of mining. Juneau's not here because of fishing. It's not here because of timber. Juneau was definitely here because of gold mining. Here in Juneau, there's really no recovery. If something super bad were to happen in a mine tunnel, I'm probably the one who's going to be able to help you get out. Juneau was definitely here because of the thought and dreams of these small miners trying to strike it rich. Unfortunately, half the time it was con artists supposedly finding a little bit of gold and then selling the idea and the small mine to East Coast investors who also wanted to get rich. It's almost like modern archaeology. You get to see the past, even though it's only about 100 years ago.
Brian Weed lives in Juneau. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. A video about the long-range radar site in tonight's AK is at our website and Facebook page. We had reports tonight from Emily Russell in Nome, Graylin Brashear and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses from art to advanced engineering and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.